say it's faked. Already on that, Trejo said and stood. The lighting stick cycled through its spectrum, getting ready to catch the subtleties of Winston Duarte's skin and hair. He'd grown thinner since the break. His eyes still had an intelligence to them, if not a focus, but his cheekbones had become more prominent. Elvie felt like she could see the skull beneath the skin, and she didn't remember thinking that before. Kelly brushed his hair, trying to put it into place the way he probably had before other addresses and announcements. Only Duarte wouldn't keep still. His hands were thinner, gray and dusty-looking, and he moved them constantly. His eyes rolled in his head like he was following butterflies no one else could see. "Is there any way to make him sit still for a minute?" Trejo asked. "He does sometimes," Kelly said. "Having people around agitates him. Give him a little time to settle." Trejo muttered something, but didn't object. Elvie waited with the others, watching the man who had, however briefly, been the god-king of a galactic empire. All she saw now was a lost man. She remembered feeling the force of his personality the first time they'd met, the sense of being in the presence of something vital and irresistible. She saw something in the way his jaw fit against his neck that reminded her of Teresa. It was easy to forget that they were also people, father and daughter. The same complicated, fraught relationship that human beings had been navigating since they developed language. Before that, probably. Without really knowing why, Elvie stepped forward and took Duarte's hand. He considered it like it was a pleasant surprise. She knelt, smiling gently, and his gaze swam through whatever dark waters he lived in now until he found her. "We just need to scan you, sir," she said. "It won't hurt." His smile was gentle and filled with an unspeakable love. He squeezed her fingers gently and let them go. She stood back, getting out of the light and the scanning radius. Duarte looked around the room like a beneficent king in his dying hours until his attention landed on Cortázar. "All right," Trejo said. "Let's get this done before..." Duarte stood, his head tilted at an angle like he was remembering something half forgotten. He stepped away from his chair. Illich made a small, frustrated hiss. "All right," Trejo said. "It's okay. Let's just get him back in position and try this again." Duarte stepped over to stand before Cortázar. His attention seemed as focused as Elvie had seen since his fall. Cortázar smiled and bowed his head, like it was something he knew he was supposed to do. Duarte's jaw worked, his mouth opening and closing, but the only sound he made was a small, "Oh." He moved his hand in a soft gesture, like he was fanning away smoke, and Cortázar's chest bloomed out at the back. It was so slow, so gentle, that Elvie couldn't understand what she was seeing. Not at first. It was as if Cortázar were an image projected on mist, and the mist was being blown away. Nothingness swirled through his chest, his face, and behind him, floating on the air, spirals of red and pink, gray and white, as ornate and beautiful as ink dropped into water. The air filled with the smell of iron, of blood. Cortázar sat on the floor, his legs folding under him, and then slumped to the side with a long, wet exhalation. The left half of his head was missing from the jaw to the crown. His heart was still trying to beat in the open theater of his ribs, but the man was gone. They were silent and perfectly still. Duarte looked up, his attention caught by something that made him smile like a child seeing a dragonfly, and his hands rose aimlessly. Trejo put the scanner down on the bed, turned, and walked quietly out of the room, pulling Elvie along with him. Illich followed, and then Kelly shutting the door behind them. They were all pale. The state building was shaking under them, tremors that matched Elvie's heartbeat. She fought to breathe. All right, Illich said. Okay, that happens. That just happens. Major Okoye, Trejo said. His normally dark face was pale and gray. I have never fucking seen anything like that. Ever, she said. Holy fucking shit. I agree, Trejo said. He knew, Elvie said. That's what this was. He knew about Teresa. Did you tell him? What about Teresa? Illich asked. What did he know about Teresa? What did she have to do with this? Let's not lose focus here, people, Trejo said, leaning against the wall. Mr. Kelly, would you escort the High Council to fresh quarters until we can get these cleaned? Kelly looked like Trejo had just asked him to put his hand in a meat grinder to see if it was running. For a moment, Elvie thought the man would refuse, but Laconians were a breed apart. Kelly nodded and walked stiffly away. We can do an announcement without him, Trejo said. I can do it, as his acting military commander. Pleased to accept the position, thank him for his faith in me, like that. We need to shoot him, Illich said. Whatever that thing in there is, that's not the High Council. I don't know what the hell it is, but the only sane thing any of us can do right now is put a bullet in its brain. Trejo drew his sidearm, took it by its barrel, and held it out toward Illich. If you're sure that'll kill him, be my guest. Illich hesitated, then looked away. Trejo holstered his pistol. Major Okoye. I know, she said, another top priority. I'll get right on it. But, I know you told Cortasa to give me full access. I've never been entirely certain he did. Trejo considered it. From the far side of the door, something rattled. A thump like a piece of equipment that had been bumped into, knocked over. If it had been the sound of violence, it would almost have been better. Trejo pulled out his hand terminal, thumbed in a code, and adjusted something she couldn't see. Major Okoye, you are Paulo Cortázar. You want to go through his room and check his underwear, you go right ahead. See what he's been eating. Check his medical records for sexual diseases. Read his letters to his goddamn mother, I don't care. That man's life is an open book to you starting now. Find something useful in it. I'll do what I can, Elvie said. And Major, I know you were a civilian before you were appointed. You didn't come up like the rest of us, so I'm going to make this clear for you. If you say one more word about surrendering the Empire, I will have you before a court-martial, and then I will have you shot. This is a war now. The rules have changed. Understood, Elvie said. They've been doing that a lot lately. Ain't that the goddamn truth, Trejo said. Then, Colonel Illich, you're with me. Let's draft this announcement. Elvie walked out of the state building like she was in a bad dream. Even the bite of the wind felt less real to her. Shock, she thought. I'm in emotional shock. That happens when people die in front of you. At the lab, Dr. Ochida waved to her as she passed, and then looked concerned when she didn't wave back. She knew that she should have stopped and talked to him, but she didn't have any idea what she'd have said. In the private lab, her private lab, Zan and Kara were sitting in their cage playing a word game they used to pass the time. They paused when she came in, but didn't ask her what had happened, what was wrong. The uneaten half of Cortázar's sandwich was still on his desk, wrapped in brown paper. Elvie threw it in the recycler and opened her work environment. All the reports and data feeds she'd been poring over for weeks. She split the screen and, with her new permissions, pulled up Cortázar's. She backed both up to the functional index. His was 118 entries longer. Elvie felt something like anger, something like dread, Something like the mordant pleasure that comes from being proven right about something shitty. What an asshole, she said. Chapter 44. Naomi. The burn was long, and it was punishing. Even with the crash couch distributing the pressure along every possible square centimeter of her body, Naomi ached her way through the hours. The only solace was the breaks for food and the head, and she kept those brief. Laconia was a slightly smaller heliosphere than Sol, with 9 planets, only one of them habitable. A single gas giant with somewhere between 80 and 100 moons, depending on where the line was drawn. 2 large planets out past that in the deep, and a rocky, captured planet hardly larger than Luna, with a retrograde orbit that swung high above and far below the plane of the ecliptic. 5 planets in closer to the sun, the second of them being her target, and the heart of the Empire. A transfer station at the gas giant, and the alien construction platforms that orbited the inhabited world. That was her battleground, and she meant to have her forces diffused through it. On the enemy's side, the voice of the Whirlwind at Laconia proper, the Rising Shamal and her sister ship, plus 4 more Storm-class destroyers. Her couch on the burn was almost as isolated as her old shipping container. Her time, even if it was painful, was her own. She studied the maps until she could see them with her eyes closed, and in the back of her mind, Bobby waited. The memories and habits of decades spent breathing the same air, drinking the same water, being part of the same organism, had made the woman a part of her. And the Bobby in her head had a lot to say. A campaign like this is an argument. You're trying to persuade the enemy of something. Talk them into it. And this time, here, you need to teach them that the danger of staying in place is greater than the danger of coming after you. For it to work, every lesson needs to support that one single thought. The Storm-class destroyer Mimetus ended its assignment in Arcadia system and rotated back to Laconia for resupply. The transit from Arcadia to the ring space was uneventful, apart from the now familiar annoyance that the most recent set of repeaters had been sabotaged. The Mimetus' transit into Laconia was very different. The moment the destroyer emerged into normal space, its sensor arrays were swamped by massive jamming from multiple sources. 6 ships positioned just outside the ring gate flooded the Mimetus with radio and light. It took fewer than 3 seconds for the ship to reset, but by then, 5 torpedoes, already launched and waiting for a target, were slamming into the ship. Informed by months of analysis of the captured storm, the torpedo strikes were devastating. The Mimetus lost maneuvering thrusters along her port side and 6 PDC emplacements. Worse, it began venting atmosphere. Its counterstrike was late and weakened. The enemy PDCs took out the torpedoes as soon as they were launched, and with its mobility limited and its port vulnerable, the destroyer fled. Its burn toward Laconia and the prospect of safety was the obvious strategy, and easy to foresee. Compromised as it was, it failed to register the field of stealth composite-coated debris in its path until a swarm of uranium micrometeorites peppered its already stressed hull, peeling back a section of the plating. A maneuvering thruster misfired as the power grid tried to compensate, sending the destroyer into a spin. Despite all that, it took 5 more torpedoes and a constant stream of PDC fire to kill it. The Mimetus fought well and died ugly. But it died. Everyone in the system saw its last hour, even if the light delay meant they saw it far too late to act. Lesson 1. You can't rely on reinforcements. Days under Byrne stretched. Naomi slept when she could, studied the movements of the enemy and the reports of her fleet when she couldn't. Her knees ached from being bent just slightly backward by the acceleration. It hadn't all been in the same direction. Twice now, Alex had shifted them. Not a full flip and burn, but a change of vector that brought them closer to the gas giant. The Laconian destroyers in the system started a burn to match, and Naomi's three Doniger-class battleships, the Carcassonne, the Armstrong, and the Bellerophon, had redeployed as if to make a full engagement just outside the transfer station there. And then they had all broken off, scattering, while a dozen smaller ships dove sunward to the inner planets. The whirlwind, capable of slaughtering any of them, stayed in place, leaving the chase to the destroyers. She'd expected the battleships to draw off the Laconian forces, but they didn't. The destroyers followed her hunt group, pushing them to a long, arcing retreat up above the ecliptic. The destroyers turned back quickly, never venturing past the gas giant's orbit. It wasn't the repositioning she'd wanted, but it worked. It would do. When the burn paused, she took a long moment before she unstrapped, just to enjoy the physical relief of a gentle half-G. Walking down the hall to the galley, her legs felt shaky and her neck ached. The others, her crew, were already there, wolfing down bowls of noodles and mushrooms, talking and laughing. They sobered when she came in. She was the adult, the commander. Who she was mattered less than what. She didn't mind that. She found Alex in the cargo bay, opening an access panel. He looked like he hadn't showered in days. Probably he hadn't. Issue? She asked.
No, we're good. I was just getting a little less pressure on the water feed to this thruster than I wanted. Thought I'd tweak it while I had the chance.
Good thought.
I was hoping we'd be getting down to the inner planets by now.
Early days, she said. There's time. The Bikaji Kama lumbered through the void, well behind the other ships. Its hold was open to the vacuum. Two groups of ships, 8 in one and 14 in the other, fired long-range torpedoes at the transfer station. The missiles burned hard, then went ballistic. Slightly fewer than 300 warheads screamed through the black, all aimed at the transfer station, and all timed to arrive within seconds of each other. And all of them, of course, were intercepted. Most were killed by the transfer station's PDCs, but a handful also fell to long-range counter-missiles launched from the Whirlwind. It didn't use its field projector, and wouldn't. Despite its power, the range was short, and the last time one had been fired in normal space, Sol System had lost consciousness for 3 minutes. The Laconians didn't want to risk their defense with a blackout. When the last of the torpedo barrage died, the expended hunt groups looped back, burning for the Kama. There the crew put on mech suits and loaders, made their way into the cargo ship's vast belly, and came out with fresh torpedoes and water and PDC rounds. A week and a half into the campaign, at the time Naomi specified, the Verity Close, sister ship to the Bikaji Kama, made the transit into the system, and bent its path to the opposite edge of the system, and opened its hold. Lesson 2. We have 1,300 systems to resupply us. You have one.
They're following the storm, Naomi said. I need to split you off. On the screen, Gillian Houston scowled.
When the time comes and you lure that murderous bastard of a ship away from Laconia, you're still going to have a planetary defense system trying to shoot you down. That's at minimum. You need me to eat that flak for you.
If you're with the attack group, the Whirlwind won't budge. Not ever. I don't like it any more than you do, but your ship used to be theirs. They know it's the best tech in our fleet. They're not going to take their eyes off it. They think you're the number one threat because you are. Despite herself, the younger woman smiled. They're right about that. I'm redeploying you. Move to accompany the Armstrong. When the time comes, I'll be part of the bait, Jillian said. I don't love it. It's a risk, but it's worth it.
Understood,
Jillian said, and dropped the connection. Naomi stretched and checked her system. 8 more minutes before the next burn. She tried to decide if she wanted to wash off or get a bulb of tea. If she didn't pick soon, she wouldn't have time for either. Or maybe she could do both. Alex, postpone the burn for half an hour. There's something I want to do.
You bet,
Alex said. Naomi went down to her cabin and her private shower, the map of the system in her mind. With the storm on its own, she could reroute the Carcassonne and 50 or so of the other smaller ships toward the transfer station. The Rossi, Quinn, Cassius, and Prince of the Face would be a minor threat and could loop down sunward, using the innermost planet as a gravity assist. There was a way that the whole process was like playing Golgo. Judging her shot, how the ball would bounce and spin off the other balls, how the next person would react to that, how each decision changed the state of the table. The Bobby that lived in the back of her head said, "A challenge of intellect, technique, and skill." Naomi saw how easy it would be to forget that the stakes were people's lives. When the Laconian capital was surrounded, ships answering to the underground and the transport union at every angle throughout the system, the barrage began. The transfer station was forgotten. Not just long-range missiles, but rocks. Cheap. Deadly. Every ship in the group sending nukes and accelerated titanium rods and holds full of gravel into intersecting orbits. Some moved fast. Some would take months to arrive at Laconia, which was a message in itself about how long the underground was prepared to draw out the fight. Nothing targeted major population centers, but there was no way for Laconia to know that for sure. To be safe, they had to defend everything. The barrage kept going, day after day, rock after rock to intercept, torpedo after torpedo to shoot down, an endless rain of threats, wearing them down hour by hour by endless hour. That was the third lesson. Playing defense means being endlessly ground down. Someday, something will get through. The whirlwind stayed in its place, guarding the gravity well over Laconia, but the destroyers ranged farther and farther. When the enemy came too near, Naomi's fleet scattered like children running from the police. Not everyone escaped. The Tucumcari, a rockhopper retrofitted to fight pirates in Arcadia, caught a torpedo in its drive cone and died in a ball of fire. The Nang Kwok, a private security company stealth ship 2 generations out of date, didn't dodge a line of PDC fire. Disabled, it tried to surrender. The Laconian ships destroyed it instead. There were others, a handful, each of them one too many. And every chance Naomi had to strike back at the enemy, to lure them out and end one or two of them, she let pass. It was the cardinal rule that she sent to every ship all through the system. Laconian military that came out after them went home intact. Because that was the final lesson she taught her enemy. It's safe to chase after us. It's how you'll win. And it was a lie. The first sign of fresh cheese in the mousetrap was the Bellerophon changing its drive signature. The Doniger-class battleship was burning away from Laconia, heading in the rough direction of the Verity Close. Even from half the system away, the drive plume would have been visible to the naked eye, a faint but moving star. And then, for a moment, it blinked out. The Rossi and her three escort ships were on the float, skating on the far side of the sun from Laconia. She'd led them in toward the Corona until even with pumping spare water onto the ship's skin and letting it evaporate, the built-up heat was at the edge of tolerance. Even when the temperature was in the error bars of normal use, it baked the resins and ceramic. The air smelled different, and it left Naomi and the rest of the crew jumpy and uncomfortable. But with Laconia's fighting ships near the planet, they were in a blind spot, out of sight. When the Bellerophon's drive lit back up, it was dirty. Half a minute after that, it went off again. The way an apex predator lured lesser hunters by mimicking the sound of wounded prey, the Bellerophon called out for help. And Naomi's fleet answered. The Storm, the Armstrong, the Carcassonne, and almost a quarter of the other ships started burning on courses that would meet the Bellerophon. The Bellerophon wasn't halfway to the Verity Close, but the light delay from it to Laconia was still over 70 minutes. A malfunctioning ship would be interesting to Duarte and his admirals. An escort fleet coming to its aid looked like something more. It looked like a mistake and an opportunity. "Come on," Naomi said. "Should I start up?" Alex asked. "Put us at half a G," Naomi said. Even if it didn't work, they'd want to be out of here soon. As comms officer, Ian passed the word along to the other ships, and the Rossi eased up from beneath her. 2 hours later, the whirlwind moved. At high burn, she headed out toward the Bellerophon and the gathering escort ships. For anyone who'd seen the Tempest destroy the combined forces back in Seoul, it was like seeing a shark darting toward a beach full of toddlers. 3 hours after that, several hunt groups on the other side of the heliosphere started burning in toward Laconia, and the destroyers went on intercept courses, ready for a slice of their own glory. There was a point long before any battle came that was her window. Not just how long it would take the whirlwind to get back, but how long it would have to decelerate before it could even start to reduce the distance to Laconia again. And the same for the destroyers. It was a window of time defined by mass and inertia, thrust, and the frailty of the human body. The time it would take even long-range torpedoes to reach them. Naomi ran the numbers, and she knew when they would see her and her little force diving in from sunward. And that it would be too late. "Alex?"
"Ready when you are," he said. "Let's go."
The burn was punishing, and it lasted hours. The distance from the sun to Laconia was slightly less than an astronomical unit. If they'd kept the burn going the whole distance, they'd have snapped by Laconia too quickly to see it. The flip came at the halfway point, and the braking burn was just as bad. Worse, because now the planetary defenses had seen them. Torpedoes darted out toward them and died in the web of four ships' coordinated PDCs. The planet itself was beautiful, blue and white as Earth, with a greenish cast at its edge that was almost pearlescent. Naomi could make out the clouds, a cyclone forming in its southern hemisphere, the jagged, black-green line of its coast where the forest stood. Naomi fought to keep them in focus. The force of the burn was deforming her eyes. "The whirlwind has turned, started its braking burn, is firing long range." The message was from the sensor ops, one of the new people. She checked it herself all the same and agreed. If this didn't work now, it wouldn't work later. This was her only shot. Fingers aching, she sent a message to Ian, suffering in the next couch over. "Send the evacuation order. Everyone goes for the gate now." She heard him grunt and took it as assent. Alex shouted, his voice strangled by effort and the G-forces pressing at them.
"Railgun fire!"
Brace for evade.
The Rossi bucked, lurched. At this distance, the railgun fire could still be dodged. The closer they came, the harder that would become. She pulled up the targeting arrays, and the beautiful blue-green sphere sprouted 5 red lines as bent as tree limbs. The platforms. The targets. Target all fire on the platforms, she typed. Fire at will. It was too soon, but only by a little bit. And there was a chance for a lucky shot. Every second they spent in the firing arc of Laconia was another chance to die. Worse, another chance to fail. Incoming torpedoes from the Whirlwind. ETA, 140 minutes. Naomi deleted the message. By then, everything would be over.
Cut the brake, she shouted. Do it now!
The Rossi fell onto the float and snapped around 180 degrees, ready to accelerate again, ready to flee as soon as the enemy was finished. There would only be one run past the planet. If they missed, they lost. The ship jerked, and Alex took them out of the path of another railgun round. The chatter of the PDCs ran through the flesh of the Rossi like the ship was talking to itself, and it was angry. Naomi's jaw ached with the tension and fear, and the joy. The small, jagged red lines grew a fraction larger.
Captain, Ian said, I have something.
Not as helpful as you think, Naomi snapped.
What do you have?
I'm not sure, Ian said, and passed the comms controls to her monitor.
It was an incoming message from the surface of Laconia, coded with an out-of-date underground encryption schema. An evac request. Amos's evac request.
Alex, she said, and the ship jumped again, slamming her left and then right again, her crash couch whipping like the seat in a carnival ride.
Alex!
I see it,
he shouted. He was out of breath.
What do we do?
Chapter 45. Teresa. The Mametus died, burning through Laconia's gate and being dismembered by the enemy ships, 2 nights before her birthday. The celebration was held in one of the minor ballrooms, with the same tasteful and understated decoration she always had. Silk banners with bright designs, glass candles that she'd loved when she was 8 and had been saddled with ever since, flowers raised in hydroponic farms in the city proper. Soft music played over hidden speakers, all of it by composers and performers living on Laconia. Half of the guests were politicians and cultural figures, adults who'd come mostly to say they'd been there and to see who was in favor. The other half were her peer class and their families. They were dressed in stiff, formal blues, just like she was. None of them seemed happy to be there. That was fair. To them, it was like having to go to school an extra session. They were nice to her. They had to be. The sense of strained pleasure almost made her happy. All the adults had smiles like masks. They made a show of congratulating her, as if not dying for 15 years in a row was an achievement to be proud of. But even while they pretended to be impressed by how mature and composed she looked, their eyes were darting around the room, trying to find her father. She had to play her role, but at least so did they. No one talked about the invasion. Not even Carrie Fisk, wearing a champagne-colored gown and a fixed grin, looking like she wanted to bolt for the door. Kamina Drummer wasn't there, and Teresa wondered what had happened to her. Either she'd lost control of the transport union and wasn't anyone anymore, or she'd been part of planning the invasion, in which case she was lucky if she wasn't in the pens. Teresa didn't care. She had her own problems.
It was still 30 interminable minutes before the dinner was served when Illich escorted her to the dais at the back of the room. The crowd got quiet without being prompted, like they'd been trained. She'd been trained, too. She knew what to do. "I want to thank you all for coming tonight," she lied with a smile. "I am honored to be in your company now, and for all the years that I've lived here among you. My mother, as you all know, died when I was very young, and my father carries his own burdens. He can't be with us here tonight, because his duties to all of us don't allow him time even for simple, honest pleasures like this. Plus which, he's out of his fucking mind, lost to all of you and to me as well, but I'm the only one who knows it, you poor fuckers." She grinned widely at the pattered soft applause, taking an angry pleasure in the raw perversity of the situation. Teresa caught sight of Elvie Okoye in the back of the room, yellow gown and her husband at her side. She was holding a wine glass in her fist like she was trying to break the stem. She knew, too. "All of you have been a family to me as I grew up," Teresa said. Illich's words didn't sound like something she'd say, but none of them knew her well enough to catch it. "I am humbled, and I am grateful." Another round of applause, and Teresa bowed her head like she was actually grateful, like she actually cared whether the enemy ships burning from the edge of the system reduced everyone in the room to ash. "You're one of the angriest people I know." She wore the words now like a shawl, smiled and made her little bows as if they weren't statements of contempt. "Please enjoy this evening as both my guest and my father's," she said, and stepped down. The guests turned back to each other, oppressed and anxious and thinking less about her than the return of the gathering storm and its pirate fleet, reminiscing less about Teresa Duarte's childhood and more about the violent death of the Heart of the Tempest. Teresa made her way across the ballroom, avoiding Illich and Connor and Muriel. She found Elvie and her husband not far from where she'd seen them. From the dais, Elvie had looked stressed. Close up, she looked angry. "Is everything all right?" Teresa asked. Elvie started, snapped out of whatever other place her mind had been by Teresa's voice. For a moment she didn't speak, and when she did, it wasn't convincing. "Fine. Everything's fine." "Well," Teresa said, "except..." Elvie nodded, the movement hinging in her chest so that it seemed less like agreement, more like someone preparing for violence. "Yes, except," Elvie said. The chime rang, calling them all to the dining room like the most privileged cattle in the universe. When they started walking, Teresa stayed at Elvie's side. Her husband was using a cane and wincing as he walked. That was fine. Teresa wanted to go slowly. "I was wondering, Dr. Okoye," Teresa said, "the falcon." Again, it took Elvie a moment to come back. "What about it?" "I wondered how the repairs were going. With everything that's going on, I mean, it is built for sustained high burn. It has breathable liquid crash couches." Elvie shuddered.
"Those are unpleasant," her husband said.
"But still, if the fighting got close, you'd be able to use it to get away." Elvie and her husband exchanged a look that Teresa couldn't quite read, like there was another conversation going on that she couldn't quite hear. "Unfortunately," Elvie said, "the Falcon was deeply, deeply compromised."
"I got a new foot, toenails and all," her husband said, "but that ship's still in pieces."
"I really don't think it'll come to evacuation," Elvie said. "None of those ships are even going to get close to the planet, and everything Admiral Trejo has at his disposal will be used to keep us all safe." "Maybe you should put a push on the repairs then," Teresa said. It came out sharper than she'd meant it to, but Elvie laughed. That was interesting.
"Maybe I should," she sighed.
And then they were in the dining room, and Teresa was escorted to the high table with Illich and a half-dozen guests more honored than Elvi Okoye. The meal was a feast. Fresh pasta, lobster tails taken from actual lobsters, gently marbled steak grown from the finest samples. The centerpieces were all Laconian flowers, and they smelled of mint and iron and resin. No one asked after Dr. Cortázar. That, Teresa had come to understand, was one of the unwritten rules. When someone disappears, don't ask why. She wondered if they'd mention her after she left, assuming she could find a way. She looked over at the table where Elvi Okoye sat. Her husband was telling a story, his hands shifting in exaggerated gestures for the delight of their tablemates. The doctor was lost in her own thoughts. Teresa wondered whether they'd been lying about the falcon. She wasn't sure, and she wasn't even sure how she'd find out. Regretfully, she discarded the plan to have them escape the invasion and take her along. She'd have to find another plan. Days passed. Weeks. The invasion proved harder to stop than anyone liked. The state news feeds kept a brightly optimistic view, treating the threat as more of an annoyance by disgruntled idiots than an actual danger to the Empire. She still had the access her father had given her to high-level secret reports and briefings, but even if she hadn't, she'd have known the reports were bullshit. Apart from the peer class, her lessons were ignored now. She only saw Illich at mealtimes. He didn't repeat his threat to force-feed her, but he didn't need to. She understood the terms of their relationship now. Having lost control over so many other things, he made up for it by controlling her. There was nothing she could do about it. "They've slipped this time," Illich said. "They panicked. That great, huge ship of theirs lost part of its magnetic bottle, and they're all going to defend it." "That doesn't seem like a bad idea," Teresa said, forcing herself to take another spoonful of the corn chowder. It should have tasted good, but the texture was slimy and it was too sweet. She swallowed and didn't gag. They were sitting in an enclosed courtyard with ivy growing up the walls and artificial lights that mimicked the sun. The actual weather was a snowstorm that was covering the gardens in white up to her ankles. Muskrat had been running through it with a wide canine grin and little balls of ice forming on her coat. Illich hadn't let her in with them while they ate because she stank of wet dog. "It wouldn't be if there was any way for them to actually mount a successful defense. They've survived as long as they have by running away. We could kill any of them whenever we chose to, but Trejo was waiting." "For what?" "For this," Illich said. He did love the sound of his own voice. The calm, patient instructor unfolding for the clueless little girl how the universe really worked. It had seemed like kindness for so many years. Now, it looked like condescension. "The three Martian battleships are the irreplaceable core of their makeshift fleet, and when you have something that important, it's natural to try to protect it. But it's an emotional response, not a tactical one, and that's why they're going to pay for it." He had said all the same things at breakfast: eggs, sweet rice with fish, seared spinach with almonds, and she let him repeat himself now. Nothing he said mattered to her anymore. "The whirlwind will go through them like they weren't there. There'll be some clean-up afterward. We won't get all of them, but they're major ships. They're even putting the storm in harm's way for this. It'll be a bloodbath. And I..." His handheld chimed. Illich scowled and accepted the connection. Teresa put down her spoon and took a sip of water. Trejo's voice was clear, and it was tense. "I'd like a word with you in the tactical office, Colonel." Illich didn't speak, only nodded, rose, and walked away. Teresa was forgotten behind him, which suited her just fine. When he was around the corner, she got up and opened the door for Muskrat. The dog trotted in, huffing under her breath. Teresa took out her handheld and opened the tactical reports. There was a moment of sorrow. They came now and then. The memory of her father telling her that she could be the leader they needed her to be. That he wanted to train her with all the things he knew, just in case. She'd been a different girl then. He'd been a different man. She missed both of them. But the pain faded quickly, and she didn't lose anything by letting it go. It always came back. The tactical reports were strange, and it took her a moment to understand what she was looking at. The broken-down battleship had repaired itself somehow, and the fleet of enemy ships was running away, but not for the far edges of the system. They were going to the gate. Most of them, anyway. Almost all of them. All of them but four. And those were in a path to Laconia. It was suicide. Four ships against the whirlwind. Unless they had a secret weapon, the way they had in Sol System. But no, the whirlwind couldn't stop them. It had already gone too far, and even with the braking burn, its vector was still away from the planet. It was fighting its own mass and momentum like a swimmer struggling against the outgoing tide. The destroyers were in the same position. They'd been tricked, lured away with only the planetary defense grid to protect them, which, in fairness, it probably could. Four ships weren't much. They'd do some damage, though. And there was only one target. She was sitting in it. She knew she should be scared, but she wasn't. She put down her handheld, scratched Muskrat's back, and thought. It didn't even feel like solving a problem so much as remembering something she'd always known. She pulled up a map of the system and added in the enemy ships, their burn times. A lot would depend on how they made their braking burns, but Illich had taught her enough about battle tactics that she could make an educated guess. Make a plan. If she called the enemy down, they'd kill her, or take her as a prisoner. She needed something she could trade for passage. She didn't know what that was. And then she did. Muskrat looked up at her when she laughed. The thump, thump, thump of the dog's tail against the ground was reassuring. Without thinking, Teresa took another spoonful of chowder in her mouth, frowned, and sprinkled some salt over the bowl. Her next bite was better. The timing was bad, but it could have been worse. She left out the window, as if she were sneaking out to see Timothy again. It felt familiar, comforting. She knew it was the last time she'd see her room, or her things, the last time she'd sleep in the bed that had been hers since she was a child. But her father had been dead for months, and it turned out she'd already done her mourning. Muskrat whined as she slipped out, dancing from one paw to the other. "You can't come this time," Teresa said. "I'm sorry." The dog whined, lifted graying eyebrows, and wagged hopefully. Teresa leaned back in and gave Muskrat one last long hug. Then she was out the window and gone before she lost her resolve. The first step, the hard one, really, was getting to the cell. It was night. The snow was still falling lightly, but it wasn't up past her shins. Getting out wouldn't be the problem. There were two guards watching over the cells, a man and a woman. They braced as she walked into the room. "I wish to speak with the prisoner," she said. They looked at each other. "I'm not sure," the man said. Teresa made an impatient sound. "Trejo has asked me to question him before. It's about the assault. We don't have time." The fear did it. The sense of an enemy almost at their gate, and the confidence that someone in power was taking care of it.
even if the voice of authority had just turned 15. They led her into the cell. She felt shaky with excitement. It was like being one of the adventurous women she'd watched on her screens, only it was real. She was doing it. Holden sat up, blinking against the sudden light. His hair was standing at odd angles, and his face had pink lines across it from the pillow. Teresa turned to the male guard. "You stay," she said. Then to the woman. "You have something to subdue him? An electrical prod?" "Yes," the woman said. Teresa held out her hand, and the woman drew a black, shining weapon with a grip all along its length. It looked like an ear of burned corn. The female guard showed Teresa where the safety was and how to trigger it. "That's really not called for," Holden said. "Whatever this is, I'm not going to fight it. You won't need those." "I'll decide that," Teresa said. She nodded the female guard out. Then it was just the three of them. Teresa, Holden, and the male guard. It was the last chance to turn back. She could still change her mind. Teresa flipped the safety clear. Holden flinched, prepared for the pain and shock, and Teresa drove the weapon into the guard's belly and pulled the trigger. He went down hard, not even trying to catch himself. "Okay," Holden said after a long, stunned moment. "That was weird." "We don't have much time. Come with me."
No. I mean, I think I'm going to need a little more explanation about what's,
Teresa felt a burst of anger, but there wasn't time for it. She started stripping the male guard's uniform off, undoing zippers and buttons, tugging at his sleeves. "Your people are coming. Your old ship. The whole invasion was a ruse to get them close."
"There's an invasion?" Holden said, and then, "They don't tell me much. But you're saving me?"
"I'm using you. I need to leave. You're my ticket onto those ships. Now hurry, we don't have time." Holden pulled the uniform over his prisoner's jumpsuit. Confinement had left him thin enough that the extra cloth just about filled out the difference. Teresa took the stunner from the fallen guard's belt and his access key and opened the door. They marched out together. The woman at the guard station had time to look confused before Teresa put her down.
"This is actually happening, right?" Holden said as she led him down the hall toward the forensics lab. "Because this is a very realistic dream, if it's not happening."
"This is happening," Teresa said. And she meant, "I'm really doing this. I have an implanted tracking device. They're going to be after us as soon as we go."
"Okay," Holden said.
"Here," Teresa said. The door was locked, but the access key opened it. She stepped into the dim room. Timothy's belongings had been moved around in the weeks since she'd been there, but they hadn't been taken away. She walked from table to table, her fingertips brushing each container they passed. It was here, someplace. It was right here.
"Hey," Holden said, "this is the pocket nuke? The one Amos had?"
"Yes," Teresa said,
"and I'm standing right here next to it."
"You are."
"And you're comfortable with that," he said.
"This is a really weird night." She found what she was looking for. The screen glowed as it powered up. She felt the seconds slipping away. Somewhere far above the planet, the rebel ships were already coming close, already engaging with planetary defense. The files came up, lockouts and protections broken weeks ago. She looked for the file for evacuation protocol and, without hesitating, shifted the call to active.
"What was that?" Holden asked.
"I called for evac," Teresa said, liking how adult the word felt in her mouth. "Not evacuation. Evac. All we have to do is get to the pickup."
"Sure," Holden said.
Sounds easy.
Chapter 46. Elvi. Going through Cortazar's hidden files was the work of days. It was horrifying. Winston Duarte had believed in Cortazar's ability, but more than that, he'd assumed that he had the man's loyalty, and that the things Cortazar told him were true. The experiment to change Duarte's body using the tamed protomolecule had been the worst kind of science, uncontrolled, unethical, speculative, and risky. He had overstated his certainty to Duarte, underplayed the risks, moved ahead on therapies based on best-guess understandings of Kara and Zan, and collected data obsessively. His notes and records read like a horror story. As the unexpected changes had come, Duarte no longer needing sleep, developing new senses, Cortazar's comments shifted. Elvi wasn't sure the man himself would have seen it, but a plaintive quality started coming into them. A sense of jealousy about all the things he could only experience secondhand. A hunger was growing in Cortazar's mind that he didn't seem aware of. Elvi tried to go through it all in more or less chronological order, but that was harder than it sounded. For one thing, the enemy fleet in the Konia system shook her concentration. Trejo was reassuring. No more antimatter was missing, and the mere nuclear warheads raining down on the planet were a trivial danger, easily avoided. Elvi started having nightmares about it, and her sleep suffered. Also, chronology wasn't how Cortazar had structured his work. Notes and results on the protomolecule-modified telomerases that had been one of the first steps were in the same files as preliminary scans and data on Teresa Duarte. NIR and magnetic scans of Kara and Zan from his initial research had annotations about Duarte's blood protein structures from as recently as the day before Cortazar died. There were some advantages. Bouncing back and forth in time, Elvi began to feel the shape not only of Cortazar's obsession, but also of the path he'd gone through. The change. His earliest notes on Teresa had been much like his plan for Duarte, with some variations. His decision to instead kill her and give her to the repair drones hadn't come until fairly recently. It was almost out of character, too. Everything she saw about Cortazar had been about pushing forward, trying things that were new. He was a discoverer at heart, and the choice to pull back and study something foundational more deeply was unlike him. It was a long time before she figured out who had convinced him to change from his usual strategy. When she did, she only told Faez. Holden? Her husband said, incredulous. James Holden put Cortazar up to killing Teresa?
I don't know, Elvis said. I think so. Maybe.
They were getting ready for Teresa's birthday party. The dress Elvi had ordered up was a yellow that had looked good on the screen, but she wasn't sure about it now. It was the first time she'd seen Fires in days. She'd been going to the labs early and leaving them late. Would have done so again if Trejo weren't insisting on keeping up appearances. Between Duarte's conspicuous absence and the breaking news that the enemy had gutted a destroyer called the Mametus, it was a harder and harder job.
That doesn't make sense, he said, but the way he said it meant he believed her.
Why? Why would he do that? The note hadn't been hidden. It was in with Teresa's medical scans and blood data, as simple and open as a reminder to get fresh socks. Holden's argument correct? Consider restarting protocol with additional subject. And every note after that, wherever it had been added, assumed that Teresa Duarte began the process already dead. Another note seemed to be a list of talking points for breaking the news to the High Council.
With your lifespan, she was going to die before you did anyway. The important thing is that we learn